Well, man, that was my brain is like firing from that one. I think all the
It was
chat
really
about
good.
the future of work and what that could look like, and the ch like personally the challenges with when someone's like, oh, we've got a new client and we need to get like a freelancer. It's like, oh, fucking hell, the process to go through to like find that person and do the interviews and get them in. I think there's such a need to make that easy, and once
Yeah.
that's easy, that just unlocks the world for people that don't want to work in a company and they just want to be like, I'm part of this thing. I get work through it as much as I want or as little as I want. And it just
Yeah.
gives me the freedom to live my life. And I think that is definitely the future of work.
And that is what we talk about in this episode with Rafi, who's the co-founder of Passion Fruit, marketing specialist marketplace. Yeah, amazing discussion. We'll go through the journey of Passion Fruit, but also just like, yeah, like you said, the changes of working with more flexibility, freelancers, what that means for marketers in for themselves and their career as well, like going from full-time in small or big companies to into wanting to work for themselves. Yeah, man, lots of great takeaway from Rafi. Very, very interesting guy. Glad we
And
got
we
him
get
on.
put on the spot at the end with a growth interview question.
Which I think we nailed, to be honest.
I think we
Nailed
did a good
it.
job, to be honest. So you guys have got to listen all the way to the end to
All
find
the
the
way to
answer
the
to
end,
that
yeah.
one.
How would we grow passion fruit? That was a good question from him. So yeah, hope you enjoy.
Hello, we haven't changed our outfits, so if anybody watches these back to back, oh shit, you did.
Change my hat.
Damn.
You spoke
Oh
too
well.
fast. All right, it's
Sorry,
fine.
guys, we did record these back to back, but that's just the way we roll.
I just had a, time for a quick break, pit stop, and a change of hat. You know, that's how I roll. I thought about this. I was like, you know.
Maybe I just changed the positioning of my hat like that, so it's
For
like
the hundreds of thousands of people watching us on Spotify right now, they appreciate a new hat.
you want to sponsor the podcast, we'll send you one of our hats with our sweat in as a thank you.
Surely there must be an OnlyFans for that. Just there's a space for every fetish, or maybe
Cap creep.
it's hard to say. I'm not gonna say. Anyway. Who are we talking to today? It might join us in a minute.
We are talking to Rafi
Rafi,
Salama.
founder of Passion Fruit, the
Yeah. Have you ever used
marketers
them?
marketplace. Spoke to him a year ago or something like that. No, never used it, but I was in touch with him when they launched, or close to when they launched. So I've been following him for a while. How about you?
Yeah, when I was freelancing, whenever that was, 2 years ago or more.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did. They sent me some interesting leads.
Hey,
Rafi.
Rafi. Hey, how you both doing?
Yeah,
All
very,
good.
very good. You just joined us. We were talking about our experiences with passion fruit, so you'll be pleased to hear. I was just
Great.
saying that yeah, a couple of years ago, I got sent a couple of, well, quite a few leads when I was freelancing, and I really loved the way, I hope you guys still are doing it, how you use Notion to like the template
No,
you
well, maybe not, but thankfully we've come a long way from that, and it's kind of fully
have
platformized now. And I think you caught us right at the beginning when we were kind of super gluing together a variety of different tools to make the sausage, as it were. But now our brilliant product team and tech team have put together something a little bit more robust. But as every startup founder knows, at the start, it's a little bit of a mess behind the screen.
Yeah. No, it's cool though. I think even using Notion to present it, I thought it worked really great. So, but anyway, we've gone straight into our experience with it without actually talking about what it is. There's probably a lot of people out here don't know what we're talking about right now. So, Rafi, do you want to give yourself an intro to Passion Fruit?
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm the co-founder here. Passionfruit is the fastest growing marketing freelancer platform in the world. So what we do is we connect the best freelance marketing talent to the best businesses in the world. And those businesses range from early stage startups, so like a seed stage, you know, backed by like a YC or Andreessen or so forth, to like scale ups like Miro and Mixpanel and Getir and those sorts of like big established startups, all the way up to PepsiCo, Mars, Wayfair, Speedo, global businesses. Mm-hmm. And it works really well for both sides. I could kind of do the whole sales pitch for both freelancers and companies, but I think the most relevant thing for this conversation is just we're really excited about a new world of work and a genuine and robust choice for both businesses and freelancers between how they run either their talent pools or their careers. Because in today's world, you know, it depends which stat you believe, 70% of freelancers are men over the age of 45. And because really that's the case, because freelancers really, like, if you have a black book of contacts, you can go out there and hit up your mates to pay you, you know, 10, 20 grand retainers when they're still in companies. But if I'm a, you know, I'm thinking of one of our specialists specifically here, if I'm a 27-year-old person of color who grew up in Tottenham, North London, I probably don't have those intros readily available. So my option is either a full-time job I'm not really into, or through Passionfruit, I can actually build a new professional life. And that's what we're really excited about.
That's really cool.
Yeah, it's very cool.
When did you launch? When was the start?
So my last job, I can get into this tangent, but my last job was setting up the new MLS team out in Miami. So I was on the founding team there. And as I was doing that, I kind of had this, I think everyone has the aha moment, but certainly a gradual aha moment, which was, I felt like I was in my dream job. Like, I'm a big football fan, a kind of tentative Spanish speaker living in my, or between London and Miami. And I came back and I just felt like all my peer group basically hated work, like, and no exaggeration, right? I was like, we've all gone to a good university, working really hard, but full-time work, there's something structurally wrong here. And me and my co-founder had been very close, and he had done a lot of great work setting up some of the diversity initiatives over at WP where we had met. And we kind of started to wash around this idea, you know, of like, is there a better way to create access for both sides? Because I think the other thing, you know, we always end up talking about the lovely story, which is freelancers and them getting new access to work. But really what's driving this is companies, and this is what I want to talk about most, is like companies rethinking how they run their whole way they make the sausage. You know, like they fundamentally don't believe in the model of like agency of record who kind of do everything and we just sit here and receive stuff. Like, there, over the last 10 years, so much has changed there. And I think one of the big spillover effects is actually, if we want to get efficiency and creative excellence, which are probably the two biggest buzzwords we hear, you can't do that if you're paying 500 grand a month, which we've seen in some case retainers for loads of account managers, loads of project managers getting all over your campaigns, because you know, I've heard this from a few different people, so I can't credit one person. But if you think of an amazing campaign or any amazing marketing work as like a very spiky object, it's different, it's unique. When loads of hands touch it, it turns into a cylinder. And that's what happens is in these big companies, loads and loads and loads of hands touch it in these big agencies. And eventually all the great work becomes the same, you know, quite plain Jane looking thing. And that's like off the menu, as it were, in lots of business now. So they're like, we don't want that plain Jane stuff. How do we create new stuff? And that's really what's driving it. I think the demand to have flexible work and get paid what you should be getting paid and work on things that interest you has probably always been there. But what's changed, or the market that's in motion, is really on the company side.
Interesting. And do you see more and more companies that are kind of adopting that mindset?
Yeah, and I think, you know, if I look further upstream, the thing that's changing most is more and more companies are, well, actually, if I go even back, it's better not to talk about companies. It's better to talk about the individuals in companies, because all these companies are people trying to get ahead in their career and do amazing things and get promotions and send an email to their mum saying, look how well I've done, mum. Like, that's what a company is, right? Like, the definition is all these people trying to do their best work. Now, those people, to get ahead, to get the promotions, to send that email to mum, need to do things which stand out from the crowd, which, you know, demonstrate a level of innovation superior to what their internal peers are doing or competitive peers outside the company are doing. So in this day and age, I think what you're seeing a lot of is, wow, there's all these, and this is very broad strokes, there's all these amazing new ways to do things. I should be one of the people doing those amazing new things, which is often why you'll see companies like, we're the first company to launch a VR experience for da-da-da. And like, the reality is, respectfully, often those things don't actually drive more salience, more mental availability in buying situations, which is what all brands should be trying to do to grow, because that's how you actually sell more stuff. But we've seen a big shift, I think, to this like individualized growth story, which is, I want to get ahead in my career. I want to push out in front. I want to do the really innovative thing. So I think what you're seeing is individuals within institutions trying to do more exciting stuff. And now we're slowly tipping into, you know, out of zero interest rate land. Okay, that exciting stuff is great, but it's also got to sell more stuff. You know, it's got to help me get more facings at Walmart. It's got to help actually move the needle. Because, by the way, when I go in front of my board, they're not just like, oh, amazing, that's cool. They're like, how much more stuff have you sold? And I think we're at this exciting point now where the new innovation is like, yes, we want new, but we can be honest and say, right, it's got to sell more product.
Yeah, I like that. So you guys, you differ, just for anyone out there that's thinking this, you differ from a marketplace like Growth Mentor in that you are effectively a marketplace to hire the talent rather than to just have someone consult for you for like a project.
Yeah, so I think the kind of appeal of Passion Fruit is threefold. We have the best marketing specialists in the world on our platform. We have a very extensive vetting process. You can work with them month to month, so it's completely flexible. And, you know, you're paying these people more or less directly. So the cost versus an agency is probably 40 to 60% cheaper than what you're used to paying. I think that message, when it is heard by, you know, folks at these big brands, of which some of our customers already, or customers we're speaking to, prospective customers, is really, really appealing. And I'm excited for the space overall. Like, I would be, you know, just with my kind of Raffy hat on, rather than trying to sell passion fruit hat on, like, I think we're in a really evolving space. Like, I couldn't tell you exactly where this is going to land in 5 years, but I think what we've done well is put together a team that really, really care and have real domain expertise in marketing, because the TAM in marketing is so huge. And, you know, one day we'll go and do product and data and analytics and consulting, but I think really verticalizing in this space is the way forward for us.
Yeah, definitely. It's interesting because I obviously work for an agency now, and I've worked for a number of agencies in the past, and you can sometimes find yourself in a situation as an employee where, especially maybe if you're in a small startup agency, and I'm thinking of one in particular that I've worked with previously, you're running a client and you're doing all of the work for that. So say the marketing team that is on that client is just one person. And then you're seeing a retainer coming in that's like 30, 40K a month. And then you're seeing your salary, and you're like, so it doesn't really add up here. But then the flip side of that is my experience as, and probably all of ours, as a freelancer, is that a company will be willing, at least hopefully this is changing and you guys obviously trying to change that, a company is willing to pay 30K when it's like to an agency, but they have no idea what the team is. But when it's just an individual, they're like, fuck that, this guy's earning taking home 20K a month, I'm not going to be doing that. So that's this like strange world that I think that kind of exists right now.
100%. And I don't think anyone's found the answer to how that all shakes out yet. Like, because exactly as you say, there's, on the human side, if I'm the brand lead at the company and I'm then paying, you know, 30K a month to this person, they're like, well, I don't get paid 30 grand a month.
Exactly.
Like, are you getting paid 30 grand? So I think, but there's some flywheel going on here where like, then that brand lead thinks, oh, maybe I should go more freelance. Because like, clearly out, like often we'll have a call and someone at the end will joke like, haha, maybe like I should sign up as a freelancer. But as my girlfriend says, it's like a truth joke. Like part of their mind has just gone.
Yeah, exactly.
oh shit, like maybe there's a different way to do it. And I think, you know, one of the mentors I have always encourages me to think much more in 5-year timelines than 5-month timelines. And I think if you take this towards 2030, it's inconceivable to me that anyone, certainly in our, and I don't think it's an age thing, but like our mindset group won't have a few different things on the go. I mean, I think you guys are perfect case in point, right? I'm sure, you know, work is full on, you do this. I think maybe startup founder will be the only profession where maybe you have to just do that.
You
to
have
get, to at least focus, in the beginning, to get it off the ground. Like, I don't know to what round, but maybe to like a Series B, it just takes all of you. But I just don't imagine a world where the 25 to 35 year old kind of up and coming next gen are just going to be doing one company or one thing. It just, it feels anathema.
I agree. And that's also true. when I first switched and first started freelancing, and I did it seriously for about a year and a half, 2 years, maybe 3 years ago, what I found on day one was like, what was I actually doing in a 9-to-5 job half the time? Because I've got 3 clients, say, and I'm doing like a day a week for each of them, and I'm achieving the same level of output for them as I was doing previously if I was working full time for somebody. So you realize that, like, sometimes this is not always the case, obviously, especially when you're working in house somewhere, not at an agency, because your time is obviously spent on a million different things. You're like, well, I was actually filling 60% of my time with random shit before. So now I've just freed up 60% to either be making more money or having more of a lifestyle business.
Yeah, it's so interesting. I think to that point, there's two big thorny unknowns that come out from this change. The first, I think, is how you measure progress and outcomes and therefore like compensation. Like in that, you know, one of the things we've noticed a lot is, you know, okay, we talk about days per week worked is like the unit of like, okay, this is how much you should be paying. But there is a more sophisticated way to do that, but it just requires very, very granular reporting. And it's like, we will get to that place, which is, it's actually not about the time. It's about what you get done, because in theory, that's what matters, but we're not there yet. And I think the second thorny question or unresolved piece that comes out is, okay, you're measuring outcomes, progress, and then comp, but how are you actually storing and reflecting that? Because one of the big things that has ruled the world for, say, certainly the last 100 years since like the Ford motor car production process is linear career progression. So like, I become, let's say I'm in an agency, it's like, I'm an account exec, then I'm an account manager, then I'm account director, then I'm an SVP, but you can put that in any industry. It's like, you're at McKinsey, you're a junior consultant, you're a consultant, you're a People, the reason why that exists is, and I always come back, it's like the email to mum thing. It's like, we want to say, hey, I got promoted. Hey, I did this thing. Like, we need to find a language in the world of freelance which gives people a sense of progression. So we're trying this. Like, literally this morning, we just shipped, our brilliant product and tech team shipped this thing called the Passion Fruit Specialist Score. And the idea is, we're trying to capture your unique identity and progress through like a gamified points-based system on Passion Fruit. It's obviously the first day we've shipped it, so we've got a lot of learnings, and we'll see how it goes. But I think the winner, or one of the winners in this space, will really find a way to give people that sense of, I'm moving forward over a period of time. Because unless we can replace, you know, I'm a Passion Fruit grade A super specialist, and convert that into a, I'm a McKinsey senior partner, it will never quite get the same traction, because we all want to send that email to mum.
Yeah, and it's also, I feel like, freelancer, like, there's been a change, in my opinion, like, between people saying I'm a freelancer and people saying I'm a consultant, because it's like, freelancer is almost seen as a bit of like a, not a dirty word, but it's like, oh, you're just shipped in to do like a 2-week contract tarting up the PPC account, for instance. But in reality, you got freelancers who's an acting head of growth or an active, you know, fractional CMO. And it's all that kind of change in the language that needs to happen for people outside of the industry to understand. Because it's like you say, your parents are like, oh, my son's a freelancer, he's you know, I don't know what he does, but he just does like 2 weeks here and there doing stuff for people. They don't really see that there's not a seniority level that, and it, you know, people, we want to celebrate success. I think in the UK we're really bad at celebrating success, and it's almost like we want to always hide our success. Whereas you go to the States and it's like, success is celebrated, American dream, right? And all of those things need to change for this to become, you know, become more of a legit thing.
I think there is in that like realm of change, there's something to going freelance or fractional and having always being in that first 3 to 6 months highest impact kind of phase that you have in any role. That's also, I think that's also fueling that that flywheel or that change these days. Like, you, if you had a company that was like fairly corporate with a lot of politics and egos and things like that, and you can see the world is changing, especially in, like, we're talking about marketing is changing, there's a lot more content that need to be put out there, you need to be a lot faster, a lot flexible, etc. You see freelancers that are already doing that, you get attracted to it, and at the same time you get the benefit of, I'm gonna have the highest impact for the people I work with from now on, never be really questioned about my ideas or my skill set, because there is also, I don't know what's the psychology behind it, but when you get someone external, you listen to that person, whatever the cost. Like, it's not even a price thing. It's like, if you get a consultant or a freelancer into your business, you get that person for that knowledge, and you tend to get yeses, at least for the first few decisions you make. And maybe they're the only ones that you will make, because then you'll move on to something else. And I think that moves the needle a lot faster. I think that makes it easier for companies to embrace change as well. I think there's a whole thing within that we could impact, but I've definitely seen it myself as well in my little stint in a kind of fractional consulting. I think that's why I like advisory as well, because as an advisor, like, you just you take like minimum amount of risk, but you get potentially like the highest impact for the company, because something you'll say will be like the shortcut for them to just be like, well, we're just going to listen to you because you've done it before, or you've got that knowledge, and you don't get into the trap of like having 20,000 meetings and debate and then making that, you know, spiky thing a cylinder, like you said. I really like that analogy.
But I think your point is it then fuels that process, progress, output thing we're discussing. It's like, okay, because really lots of people do get paid quite literally to sit in meetings all week versus doing things. So it's like, okay, if we started to measure things on outputs, outcomes, like, what would go away?
Yeah, exactly. If you measure things on actions and outcomes, it'll change things. A lot of times in big companies, you're fighting someone else because, not because the idea is bad, it's just because it's they feel threatened in their way. Yeah. They're going to be measured as themselves as an individual, and they fight back as it's not even that they're a bad person, it's just the way they're being measured as an individual in that company is being threatened, so they have to be defensive on an idea or on change, because that's not how they're being measured. That's something that I struggled a few years ago before the pandemic, in some of the roles I had when the companies were getting bigger. I didn't understand, like, it took me up until like very recently to understand that concept, that it was not the person trying to fight any idea, it was just like the structure of how people are rewarded.
It's really interesting.
And
I think something will change when, I mean, you guys obviously fantastically successful, when like the real, you know, captains of industry or joint chiefs of staff of these brands are people who have grown up with this mindset. You know, I think it's a big difference when it's like those joint chiefs of staff, as it were, have grown up on a diet of 2 million a month agency retainers paid in a certain way, and they go to Cannes and they shake hands, and that's just how business gets done. I think, you know, the number of, you know, I guess you'd call them like early adopters, but the number of people who have started to use passion fruit at these big companies, almost all of them are these like change makery types who are like, when I'm CMO of the whole thing, I'm going to run things a little bit differently. And I think it can be really interesting when those people are the CMO, because invariably that's what happens. Like, those people will become the CMOs of everything. What then gets cascaded down? And, you know, I don't want to pin everything on in 5 years' time, but I think it's probably like a fair timeline.
Yeah. Do you have an idea already in like what a marketing team would look like in 5 years' time? Like in-house versus external?
Well, I think one of the things we chatted about when we were on text before the show was people love a template that they can copy. Like, it's like, okay, this is, and you have a better view on this than I do, but this is the team that Depop used to scale to, you know, X million users. And it's like, wow, we should have that as our team. Or like, you know, if you speak to some of the brilliant folks who were early at Gymshark, like this is what Gymshark put together to like build Gymshark. And I think oftentimes the reason, and maybe you're going to correct me, but the reason why those businesses did so well is they were really brave enough to run it their own way. And that's one of the values we have here, is like, be brave enough to run it your own way, because every business is different. And yes, you can borrow a little bit from there and a little bit from there, but actually there's the 30-40%, which is completely unique to you, that you've got to build for yourself and stick your neck out and say, this is how it's going to work for us. So I think if as long as that's in place, I guess the bit I would say we'll definitely see more of is just, you know, those kind of internal leaders being a much leaner group, absolutely. And then dipping in and out of talent as and when they need it. But I think the exciting thing is right now you have a very uniform way of doing it, right? Like every brand will have this and will have that. And I think in the future, we'll have the technology and the platforms like ours to just allow for a lot more complexity.
Yeah. No, it's true. And it's also combined with the fact that up until we're still in the very middle of that change. You used to be measured on how much budget you spend and how big is your team. Those two things. Those are the things that you talk about in the events and stuff. It's like, or in interviews, when you go to a new job, you're like, how many people did you manage?
Yeah, that's really interesting.
And that's changing. Maybe it's more like, now can you manage external people, internal people? Have you managed we worked with creators, whatever. Like those kind of things are like the new type, maybe questions you'll get to ask. On the on the finding your own way, like, is there, do you have any learnings from yourself with Passion Fruit, like that you that could be examples on how you maybe did things differently to grow as a marketplace?
I mean, I would say, you know, the obvious one to me would be verticalized, but we were always going to do that. Like, I don't think you can be credible across multiple industries in the beginning. But I think most people would agree with that and would figure that out.
Like rebundle. Is that
debundle? I just
unbundling.
You occupy the tiniest fraction of your customer's mind, like infinitesimally small. And all that can allow, I think, is like one word or like two words in our case, like marketing freelancers. Like that's all we get to own right now. Mm. And one day when our, you know, budget for our own marketing is not a couple of million, but a couple of hundred million, like maybe we earn the right to own all freelance or whatever. But like right now, like all I want the CMO of our customer at Pepsi to think is like they do great marketing freelance, and that's like that's a fantastic space for us to occupy in their mind. The most like aggressive thing or the most like deliberate thing I did was just like really, really stay close to everything, in the sense of, I think there's a big misconception about the difference between like micromanagement and giving people independence. Like, I hope if you would ask anyone on Team Passion Fruit, they're like, I have total independence to like run this. Like, Rafi's not checking over my shoulder. He's not sending my emails for me. But I think the job of the founder is like to be the best coach to the team as possible. And I think what I see a lot of like my peer group, or like, you know, because you grow up with a certain set of peer founders who start at the same time.
Yeah.
They're a bit too willing to be like, oh no, you guys crack on. Like, I'm at the beach. Like, you know, and that's maybe a little unfair, but I think you have to find that balance between everyone feeling like they've got the breadth and depth in their role to go and do stuff. But like, you can't pretend you're this massive company. I think like, and I think that comes back to just a humility of where you're at and how much you own the mental availability of the people you care about.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And also, I mean, me and you have both been in a situation in the past, very often speak about it personally as well, where you're working with a founder that is literally micromanaging everything, and it's so stifling to creativity or to doing what needs to be done. And we spoke about this on a couple of episodes ago. It's like the deviation from, if you're a founder, I know it's interesting to get your thought on this as a founder, right? You start a business with this like future vision of like what it's going to be, and then you start running it, and then it starts kind of changing, and the way that people use it, or the types of people that use it, and you end up going in a different direction. But then I think sometimes the founder's like, no, let's steer it back in this direction and go against everything that the market's telling us, because this was the initial vision and that's what we're going to strive towards. And I feel like that can sometimes be a very difficult place to be.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, there's lots of self-doubt in the sense of there's lots of, I don't 100% know that this is the right thing, but the reason why, well, I'm in my role and my role is to make the decision that other people aren't making, so I'm going to make that decision. I think, you know, maybe like a Brian Chesky always knew, and every time he knew, I don't know, maybe the great founders just have zero self-doubt. But I think a lot of it is you have incomplete information, much more than you have complete information, and ultimately you're paid to make those incomplete decisions, which are really hard. And if you get them wrong, and everyone will get some wrong, it's embarrassing, and they're like, ah, you got that wrong. But I think everyone has their kind of cross to bear, and I think the most important thing is you just take the decision at the time. When you take the decision at time, it's the best decision you could have taken, because in hindsight everything looks wrong or whatever.
Interesting. Well, okay, taking it back to kind of a growth focus. When I first found out about Passion Fruit was from somebody who was also freelancing, told me that they were getting some work through that, and then they referred me and I came in. Shout out to Ellie on the team, who was great. And is that what you guys see as maybe initially or even still now the kind of core growth, because the core of your growth engine is referral between freelancers?
Yeah, so one phrase that we always use internally and externally as well is, no one starts a freelance career because of better invoicing software. And what we mean by that is, or what we remind ourselves about, is that the liquidity of work is the most important thing. Mm-hmm. And actually, when we started, there were a couple of, you know, and listen to crap on competitors as it were, but you know, it's hard, but there were a couple of people who were building like freelancer payroll and freelancer invoicing, and like, and they got really good fun. And we've been privileged to have great funding, you know, raised 4.3 million from First Minute and Playfair, and like, but they raised great funding, and it was like, wow, they're really buzzy. And I just kept speaking to these freelancers, and I was like, why would you start a freelance career and pay for this without the work? Like, my view is, if you own the work, you get the right to own all the downstream opportunities, right? Like, let's say we have our invoicing software and another company just does invoicing software, and I say, to work on Passion Fruit, you have to use our invoicing software, and I'm bringing you all the jobs. Well, you're going to use our invoicing software. So to answer your question at the beginning, what we're laser focused on is not allowing tens of thousands of people onto Passion Fruit, keeping it like a small base of really brilliant people to begin with, and trying to get a really significant share of earnings for those people, such that we're not 100% of their earnings, because that's like, you know, that's just like their entire life, and we don't want to be their entire life, but we want to be enough of their earnings that they couldn't imagine life without us. So if you're 25, 30% of your earnings, or asked differently, if I took 30% of your pay packet away from you every month, you'd be like, holy fuck, where's my payback yet? If it was 2%, right, I'd probably still be like, holy fuck, that's my 2%, but I'm a lot less likely to be really aggrieved. So I think it's about finding that sweet spot between we really, really matter to you, but there's enough for everyone to go around. And obviously, as our share of wallet on the customer side get bigger, you can do that for more and more people. So it's definitely on the freelance side all about referrals and word of mouth. And we've been privileged to bring on a brilliant kind of supply growth lead, a brilliant lady called Lara, who set up supply growth for Uber out in Middle East, North Africa on their jump bikes. And she's just come in to oversee all of that. So we're taking that really seriously, and there's definitely some work to be done. But when you put money in people's pockets, especially last year, they will talk about it.
Yeah, definitely. And so on that point, it should be really interesting to understand how do you guys tackle that supply challenge?
So it's been interesting, like as we context, up until summer last year, the only customers we served were startups. One, because they have much quicker adoption cycles and you can actually build stuff with them and they'll give you really quick feedback. And the other thing is just like, we wanted to sandbox the product. We didn't want to, there aren't 10,000, maybe there are 10,000, there aren't 100,000 companies like Pepsi in the world. You know, like you kind of get one go every 2-3 years with a company like Pepsi for them to really like land and adopt. So we're like, the day we have a conversation with Pepsi, which we, you know, privileged to have because we both worked in marketing, that like we've got those legacy relationships to build those conversations. We want to make sure that 100, 200 startups have like got rid of a lot of the low level mistakes that we're definitely going to be making. So when we made that switch to startup to enterprise, what we noticed is not all, but some of the specialists we had brought on for startups are really focused on startups. Like, for example, the concept of like growth marketing doesn't really exist in big brands. Like it's very much like a startup thing. And then in big brands, you'll get a lot more of a need for like, you know, brand partners who like look after the brand, for example, which don't really exist in a startup. Because if someone came into Passion Fruit and was like, I'm the brand partner, like, and I'd be like, well, that's not what we need. We need to grow the business. So you start to notice some discrepancy between the startup and enterprise. And I would say, given that we started the enterprise in like September of 23, we've started to only just now really get on top of what are all the different needs that these big businesses have. I would say now we're there and like we're really clear on what that is, but definitely, and I'm sure this will be the same when we move from say marketing into data and analytics as like a vertical, you've got to figure out the lay of the land. And one phrase I always love is like, the map is not the territory. Like you can Google this stuff and like, it'll be like, these are the most common like needs in a da da da. But like, you've got to get into the territory. And I think, you know, if I had one criticism of VCs in general, it's like, they are obsessed quite literally with market maps, but they don't really ever get into the territory. And the best VCs, and you know, Adriano and Henrik, shout out to them, are very, very good at understanding the topography of the customers we're working with. And I think that's so important as a founder and as a commercial team, is to really inhabit the world of your customer at like their level, not what you can see on the internet.
And bringing on those, I guess bringing on the startups in the early days, was that just a kind of very manual, traditional kind of sales process?
Yeah, I think we had a thesis that YC companies would be keen to adopt. Like there's a big thing in YC of buy from your batch mates. So if I'm in a YC batch and we sell insurance policies or whatever, and then someone else does HR, like they can use my insurance and I'll use their HR or whatever, however it works. Yeah. So we're like, they're very open to it. And also what we wanted to say is X% of this year's YC batch use Passion Fruit. Because we knew that for other founders, that would be a really good symbol of like, the best startup founders are using this. So I think in the very beginning, I mean, the first 1 to 10 customers, you just need to show up their bloody house and be like, you know, trust us, trust us, trust us. But like beyond that, what you need in that first 1 to 10 customers is like a shield of legitimacy that you can just like walk into a meeting and be like, look what it says on the shield. Like, trust us, trust us. And eventually that grows, and we found this list of the top 100 VCs in the world. And we were able to say portfolio companies from, I think the number was 76. 76 of the top 100 VCs in the world trust and use Passionfruit. So then it started to be like, oh, all the VC-backed startups are using this. And so when you go and meet like a Miro or Mixpanel, who are like, I would say our flagship, like scale-up customers, and they're like, all the innovative seed and Series A startups are using this. Like, we should be using this because we're still a startup. Yeah. Like, you sort of graduate through the layers of legitimacy. And then when you meet a Mars, it's like all the big shiny scale-ups use this. Like, that's what the clever people are doing. So you kind of need to create this layered effect where at each step you get more and more credible. And then what happens in the big businesses is there's sort of centers of power, and then there's the edges of power. For example, like, if I think of a brand like Unilever, right? They will have one or two brands in their portfolio, maybe one to three, which is, if they don't hit target every year, every other brand can get stuffed. This is what moved the needle. No, and maybe exaggeration, but I would say no new service provider, whatever you do, is going to get given those brands straight off the bat. What you need to show is at the edge of the center, whether that's in a brand sense, a geo sense, like, you can start to make initial pieces of work, because that's how you start to build the credibility internally to go after like the big, big brand. And that's not, you know, we are absolutely infatuated with our customers at those big brands already. Like, and we're so pleased and privileged to like have the chance to work with them. But generally, if you want to grow into one of those big accounts, the most important thing is that you find a way to demonstrate that you're good enough without having to do the big, big, big thing first, because you're never going to get given that.
It's interesting, because in you guys' case, doing that, proving that you're good enough, is a massive reliance and trust in the freelancer on your platform, right? There's a lot of pressure on them to deliver. Is that you obviously have your internal creme de la creme that would get put forward for those roles, because you can't just trust any old Joe Blogs to kind of fuck that up.
Yeah, well, that, and I think that's why the specialist score is so important. Like, what we're saying is, and it's not just through the work, it's through how often you're reporting on your work. It's through, are you mentoring other people on the platform? Are you uploading your invoice on time? It's all sort of reliability metrics. What we're saying and what we're building is like an internal SEO within Passionfruit, which is like, we're not the arbiters of who gets access to the best work and the highest paying work, or whatever it is. It's like, behavior on the platform means that when projects come in and get matched, the people with the best scores are going to get matched to them. So what we're saying is, you actually have the chance to be the captain of your own destiny. And if you do great work and like behave in a way which means that there's going to be more work on Passionfruit overall, you should get the biggest share of that enhanced pie, if that makes sense.
That does make sense. And do you find that if there is, you know, somebody does take an opportunity and it doesn't work out, not because they're shit, just because, you know, it doesn't always work out in the realm of marketing, do the companies push back and go, oh, you know, Passionfruit didn't work for this? Or can they understand that it is a kind of relationship business?
I think the honest answer is, at the earlier stage, you actually don't get to fuck up. You don't get to fuck up. That's my view. And that doesn't mean it won't happen, but you can't really build a plan around the idea that you're going to fuck up. You see what I mean? Your idea has to, your plan has to be, we are going to nail this so holistically that every single aspect is going to be taken care of. Occasionally you'll have like, you know, and Johan, I'm stretching my French here, but like a force majeure event where like, you know, we sadly had one incident recently where one of the specialists working on one of our big brands, their dad died. And it's like, well, okay, you can't mitigate for that. You replace them. But generally, the way you've got to be thinking is, I'm crossing all the T's and dotting all the I's to such an extent that like, at least in the beginning, there are no fuck ups. And I think that's, like, I'd be lying to you if I said, oh, and here's like our robust contingency plan for when like someone drops out, or like, you know, and on the very odd occasion it happened, the entire company is working to get it fixed within the shortest time frame possible. Because the reality is and you know, every VC wants to be like, oh, that's the stickiest new product ever. Like these big businesses, like if they lose faith in you, then you will never hear from them again. You know, like startups much more like, oh, well, let's go for a beer. Let's catch up. Sorry about that, mate. Like these big companies, like stock prices move on. We saw with Bud Light, right? I think the Bud Light thing is so overworked. But the one thing I'm interested in as a topic off the back of it is like people forget that, you know, marketing affects price, marketing affects employee retention, marketing affects sales. But the number one thing it affects and people see is like that share price piece and what the CEO is able to communicate to board members if there's been a big blow up. Like you can't make mistakes with really big brands marketing. And so if they think that there's any risk, they're just going to go, don't worry about it, guys. Like, come back to us in a few years when you've got this right.
Yes, I can see the business is fairly stressful one for you at that level.
Yeah. But you know, we've got a brilliant team. Like our tech team, led by a brilliant person called Pedro, they put a lot of time and effort into this stuff. Is my co-founder, who leads on all the product and operation stuff, is incredibly meticulous and on it, and has a bunch of skills that I could never hope to have in that sense, right? So I think if you keep going back to the core of passion fruit and the core of growth and all this stuff, it's just like, can you assemble the best people working on your business, whether they're full-time, freelance? Ultimately, it doesn't matter. It's just, as we were saying, like, be brave enough to create the arrangement that works for you. And yes, there's a lot of, I mean, I don't know if even three steps forward, two steps back is fair, but there's a lot of steps back, it feels like, right? But if you've got enough of the right people in there, quarter on quarter at least, you'll look back and be like, wow, we made a lot of progress.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love it.
How many, I wanted to ask you, like, how many marketers do you have on the platform now, if you can share?
No, I mean, we're constantly refining it. I think the latest check right now is like in the low thousands.
Nice.
Which is graded between people who, you know, run their whole career on passion fruit to people who have just joined, and you know, so it's not like not all of those are weighted the same as it were in terms of how much passion fruit means to them. I think one I mentioned Lara before, like I think that's what we're really excited for her to come in and do, is think a lot more strategically about why that number is that number and what it means and how we grow it in ways we want to grow it. Because maybe I could have been more specific when you asked about growing at the start. Like every marketplace goes through different stages of demand constraint, supply constraint, demand constraint, supply constraint. Yeah. And I think in B2B marketplaces, when you're trying to unseat a legacy way of doing things, almost always you are demand constrained to begin with. Like if you listen to the real people who have smashed B2B marketplaces, like a Rebus or, you know, the Incredible Health, or there's a couple of those nurse marketplaces out in the States. Like it's about going into hospitals and saying, hey, hospitals, like you could run your nursing differently. It's relatively easy to go to a nurse and say, like, would you like more flexibility and like hours that suit you and pay that's better and a choice of like it's not easy, but compared to like getting a hospital that runs everything on a clipboard and has done for 500 years, you see where the battle is. Then what happens is all the hospitals go like, oh, we should not run our thing on a clipboard anymore. And for us, it's like, oh, we shouldn't just work with these massive agencies on retainers. And then what you see is the demand actually starts to flow a bit more loosely and your growth is stopped by the supply. And I think that's the interesting moment we're about to move into over the next 6 to 9 months, is like, actually the word gets out in like a Pepsi and you're all over the business and everyone wants to use it. And actually it's like, whoa, they have a lot of demand, right? How do we segment this?
Nice. You mentioned Pepsi a few times. It's a reminder for me to reach out to their CMO. I want him to go on the podcast.
They're doing some brilliant work. It's an exciting space. You've got every couple of years, there's a new drink like Prime that comes. And PepsiCo is obviously a lot bigger than just the Pepsi drinks brand.
Yeah, of course.
As it relates to the main Pepsi flagship brand, it's an amazing category because you've got challenges like Prime that come in and burn out, and then the next one comes in. You're trying to balance. It's a great challenge. Like, if you love amazing work, I think their marketing team is a good place to go and work.
And just so we're clear, also listen to clear, when you talk about supply and demand for passion fruit, supply is the roles or supply is the freelancers?
Supply is the specialists, the freelancers, and the demand is the customer brands who
seeking
have.
Interesting.
Well, yeah, I would love your, we talked a lot about my views on passion fruit growing. How would you grow it? And assume that right now we're still just probably, if I had to pick, demand constrained. We're less focused on how do we get more freelancers. Although, you know, that, as I say, that's probably starting to enter the foreground a little bit more. But would love to put your minds on the spot and just back of a napkin. Or maybe not hit the whole plan. Like, what would be like one lever you would pull? And like an example, like I think we could do a better job of working with like B2B influencers, of which you're probably both in the category, to get the message out there.
Especially
here. Yeah,
yeah. That's one lever, you know, like, but I would love if the levers come to mind for you too.
There is, I think there is a big opportunity for any B2B businesses at the moment, and we spoke about this when this comes out 2 or 3 episodes ago with Cody Schneider on the B2B podcast avenue. I think any business, and yours included, should have a podcast where all the episodes are your target audience, your demand, and you literally ask them the questions that are around what your business do, and you ask them to like think about it on the fly as you're interviewing them. And that's your content strategy, at least on the demand side, everywhere. You can clip that, do whatever you want with it, put it on a newsletter.
Yeah.
I think that will that will just generate your leads and your content at the same time. So that's the one thing. But it's not a small thing. Like that would run your whole engine, basically. But I would put that in place very very quickly. It's easy to set up, and then you just take some time to like run it.
Starting a podcast is your answer to every question at the moment.
I think there's definitely something in it. We did very early, we were guilty of that thing of like we did 8 episodes of a podcast and then didn't continue, but it was more around when we were trying to get startups. We did a lot of like VC talent team interviews because we were like trying to get access to the startup through the VC talent teams, and then the startups not being the focus, it didn't make as much sense. But yeah, it's interesting. I can't remember what the exact name of the brand. I think they're called like Life Fitness or Lifetime Fitness. And it's like something like a Soho House, but more focused on the gym side of it. Like it's like these beautiful, you know, you can imagine like sunny American countryside fitness clubs with pools and gyms. And there's like a place your family can have lunch. It's like, it's Life Fitness or Lifetime Fitness. And when I saw it, it was the same week that WeWork collapsed, which is the same model of like pay subscription, access any club. I mean, slightly different usage, but it always reminded me like, if you're producing something of quality, there's always space for more. And with the podcast thing, like if, like with you guys, you know, if you're producing a great podcast, it doesn't matter how many podcasts are out there, the cream is going to rise to the top. And I think it's a good reminder when you see a brand like that, it's like in the same week that WeWork, actually something else is going to pop.
Exactly. And I think there is something to the distribution of that content. So it's not the podcasting itself is one thing, but it's how you, what you do with it, that is almost as important, if not more important. Because if you get, to go back to the Pepsi example, if you get someone quite senior at Pepsi who's already working with you, or maybe is not working with you, it doesn't have to be a customer, but you create that content with them and then you distribute it in a way where your other CPG brand or like the big corporation like see it in these roles. And maybe there's some organic ways to do that. There's some paid ways to do that, to be very account-based, targeted. They'll see the content. They'll be like, oh, what are these guys I keep seeing over and over again? They talk about this way of doing, working with marketing in a freelance way. This seems cool, and then that's how you like grow the awareness over time, because like you said, like it takes a long time to sign someone like this. You probably get a shot every 2-3 years, but I think if you do that for long enough, it's the edge of the center, like you said, you know, you do that with a few of them and eventually you get to the to the center, to the biggest brand.
I think that's true. I mean, by the time this probably goes out, he will have joined, but we've just brought someone in to kind of, his title is marketer in residence, but to kind of really head up our marketing department. And one of the things that is most appealing to me about him is he's really, really good at CRM, like HubSpot CRM, segmenting, getting people out. Because I think to your point, Johan, if I didn't know what the business was and I was asked a question that I asked you, which was how would you grow it? I would say stick another X amount of money and effort into CRM, and whatever content you've already got, get it in front of your customers once a week, once a fortnight. We do a really poor job of it.
Yeah.
It hasn't been a priority, but like, it's the easiest way is just to take everything you've got, repurpose it, put it into a little GIF or a little whatever, send it out again. There aren't 1,000 different messages they need to hear. They just need to hear the same thing.
Yeah.
I think my...
Go for it, Jake.
It's kind of what I was thinking just as you guys were talking there, and something that maybe pushed back a bit against the content piece. I think that's super important, but also I wonder if, going back to right at the start of this, Rafa, you said that decision makers or like VPs, whatever that level is, still very much white, middle class, older guys, right? And it's like, I would be interested to know how many people, how many VPs of Mars, for instance, are scrolling LinkedIn and consuming content in the way that we do. And I feel like there's a level of people where they will only trust a recommendation from someone who is paid big money to give them recommendations. So it's like C-suite advisors, the coaches, the non-execs that are on the boards of these companies. And like, how can you create a rev share with those people prove the value first, because they're not going to want to suggest something that isn't good, but you know, give them an incentive to, in those meetings when they're talking about changes to the hiring process or changing to the HR process, to drop passion fruit in there and give them a bit of a kickback. And that could be one, easy to suggest but not easy to do, and probably not the right one. But I wonder how much, and you can answer this question, how many passion fruits are out there for data science? Because I feel like there's so many of these cool things that are built around marketing, because we all appreciate like marketing is this interesting world where it's like cool new things come out all the time, people are interested in it. But a world like data, I feel like could be a blue ocean for something like this.
It's really interesting. I mean, on the second point, I think that multi-product piece, I'm a big fan of Jason Lemkin. I don't know if you know Jason Lemkin. He runs Sasta, and he's very good Twitter presence of just like early stage startup sales advice. But his big thing is like, once you get to like 10 to 20 million ARR, which we're not quite at yet, but like once you hit that, that's when you have to go multi-product. And I think at that point, because the TAM of any given market, once you actually figure everything back, like, you need to have different product and category entry points. And I think that's logically, I completely agree with you. Like something like a data science makes a ton of sense for us, because it's probably often a lot of the same buyers or like adjacent to our existing buyers. And would definitely feel like white space or green field, as the folks at DoorDash used to call it. I think the first point is really interesting to me, which is there is a, you know, people talk a lot about like, does cold email work? And I'm like, okay, well, to me, that's not the question. The question is, how do CMOs buy? And I think CMOs buy when their friend at the, senior conference says, oh, we start using this. Or their person who goes to their very expensive like golf club says, we've started using this. Or like, I don't think the question is, does cold email work? It's like, how do your customers buy? And maybe if you're selling to a different profile, fine. But for us, like, you can definitely make headwind with like more junior people at a company. And like, and I think it's a very good way to do like, you know, top to bottom, like have both and get intel from both and work. I don't think you should discredit it. But in terms of like CMOs who are going to buy, I completely agree with you. Like, who are the whisperers in their ear, the keeper of the keys? We actually did set up a, we had like a passion fruit advisory board because our initial hypothesis was, there's an example of like not failing, but getting it wrong and having to change tack, which was we thought that in enterprise companies, all the people stuff, i.e. freelancers, would be handled by the chief people officer, CHRO suite. Mm-hmm. We built this amazing advisory board and lots of people are still friendly of the business and great, but it was all chief people vibes. And that was been, that was this time last year with a view we were going to set up the enterprise stuff in the summer. But what we realized is marketers made the decision about marketing freelancers for whatever reason. Like it didn't happen in the talent pool. So the advisory board made a lot less sense for us. Yeah. But yeah, it's definitely something, I mean, I'm not going to say watch this space because hopefully your lives are more interesting than checking whether we launch our advisory board. But I think that will be something you'll see from us this year is 2.0 of that, but going after the segment that really matter. Because I feel like my mum is on my mind. I keep talking about mums on emails. Even those people who are super senior, feel like they've accomplished it all. Maybe it's not their mum, but like they still want to say, hey, oh, I got invited onto this advisory board and like, it's awesome. And like,
yeah,
new startup. And like,
yeah.
I answered that question poorly earlier, Joanne, or like maybe the most contrarian thing that we've done is like whenever we've encountered a problem, we've gone to like a very individual level and thought, as a human being, what matters to them? Like what actually is the thing that moves the needle in their world and how are their incentives set up? And I think if you look at that, like I'm making this profile up, 50-year-old CMO has accomplished it all, LinkedIn's gone through all the jumps. There's kind of, they're not going to become a CMO, but like they've kind of accomplished everything. They probably look to their left and right and it's like, oh, that person's now like a junior member of their old university's board. Oh, that's cool. Like I should be doing more stuff like that. Like, oh, and then they get asked to be like a junior member of like a charity board and they do that. And they're like, oh, but like, where's my, like, I've now got like 20 grand spare. Like, where's my like angel investing thing going on? Like, all this stuff. Like, and that's what it's about. It's like inhabiting that world with them and being like, what's it like? So I think for us, like there's a real clear blue ocean, to use your nice phrase, Jacob, like how do we figure in their constellation of stuff that they want in their life?
I like that. That's really nice. And on the angel side, right, if you can tap up people that are angels or trying to be angels, they want to go in, they want to give value, they say, this is who you need to use. I mean, I've worked at loads of startups where the VCs, well, you know, like most startups, I suppose, pull a lot of the strings, and they're like, you guys are going to be using passion fruit for your hiring process.
A lot of our angels at the seed round, you know, we're really privileged to have folks who were early in marketing at Stripe and Deliveroo and Airbnb and all these sorts of places, because at the time the story was very much around startups and they were like, oh my god, I would have used that. So they follow
and that. Just quickly on the CRM or cold email combined with the podcasting, one thing that we did discuss in the podcast a few times in the past is that this seems to be a trick with plugging a podcast into a cold email that seems to be working very well, because you're not selling anything, you actually give them the value. So if the people that you respect, or those angel investors or the CMOs of the world, is what you share in your email to others, they might see that as
that's really interesting. There's one little nugget on that, which again goes down to the human thing. I was at a sports event maybe 3 months ago and realized that, not in my seat, but like at halftime, I was sat having a cup of tea and I was sat next to the CEO, in fact, of a publicly listed company. I just recognized them and I was like, oh, wow, it's them. But I wasn't going to say anything because I was like, just enjoy your game. But I did maybe cheekily take a look at what they were looking at on their phone at halftime. And they were halfway down the Instagram page of the High Performance Podcast Instagram profile with their AirPods in, listening to an episode on like how to drive performance in a team. And again, you realize like the CEO of Ford has his or her, I think it's Merit, her, has their media mix, which they listen to and they get advice from. Like everyone wants things which are interesting, valuable, make them a better person. Because I'm pretty sure, to my Brian Chesky comment, no matter what level of CEO you are, there's a bit of self-doubt, or at least a degree of I could be doing this better. And if you can fill that gap, like, which I'm sure you guys do for growth and marketing leaders at startups and bigger companies as well, like, you're filling a void which makes them go, oh, I got a little bit better today. And of course they want to hear from you on that basis. Like, what they'd be, it would be irresponsible for them. One of the things we often talk about is, like, how is it irresponsible for a marketing leader not to engage with us?
And to that point, Ravi, it sounds like what you need to do for that growth thing is sponsor a podcast.
You guys, to be fair, I mean, it's not on the lever list.
Well, don't worry, it's not a proposition. But that was incredible, but we've definitely come up against it. And so if there's any final things that we want to touch on, otherwise we can kind of wrap things up.
I think my the thing which really stuck out to me, kind of as I look back at what we've discussed, is the bravery to run it your own way piece. Like, especially if you, I'm right in assuming your audience is primarily like startup marketing and growth leaders. Would that be fair? Like,
number one.
And by the way, that's not just from what we've learned, but seeing all our startup customers and what's worked for them. It's the opinionated, contrarian, like, this is going to work for us. And I might never have read it on a blog, or I might never have heard it done, but like, my intuition says this is going to work. Okay, let's do it.
Yeah.
Good one. Where can people find you? Little plug for yourself.
In the Farringdon office, quite a lot.
Where's the office in Farringdon?
We are just off Leather Lane, basically.
Sorry, I just realised you probably don't want to tell him.
No, you can.
But I'm in Farringdon quite often.
Anyone, feel free to come and say hi. We did actually have, weirdly enough, one of our specialists who showed up unannounced once, and that was actually quite weird because it was like, how did you find this? But anyway, we're in Farringdon, or we spend a lot of time with our customers in the States, so there. But best way, easiest way, is just on LinkedIn, Rafi Salam.
Amazing,
man. That was brilliant. I really enjoyed that. Hopefully you did as well.
Yeah, it was great, and I'm grateful for you guys making it. Like, I'm not just blowing smoke up your ass. Like, I think there is a lot of room for great, like, material, which, and I've listened to a few of the other episodes, which just like helps people figure out what they don't know. And even if 0.01% of the things we discussed help someone else, like, I think that's about the best we can hope to do.
Hi, Johan and Jake. Great podcast. Love hearing you in the Growth We Trust. Your merchandise, his hats, looking forward to seeing them in the flesh, so to say. Yeah, so keep doing the great work you're doing. My name is Pedro Coto Lopez. You can find me on LinkedIn. So big shout out to you guys. Thanks.